All right. Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris. And this week, I'm not looking for any book recommendations because it's a recap episode.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. You guys have no idea what we're doing, do you?
No, I'm pretty nervous.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, I thought I kind of explained it. Did I not?
Well, you sent us a list of books that we have talked about.
Oh, okay.
Which was good. Yeah. You sent us a list of books that both Ian and I have talked about, and you said, these are the books that I'm going to talk about. So if you could like prepare notes for them, that would be great.
Let's be honest. Nick, seriously, you've heard so many of these, and you realize you hate reading, and this is our series finale.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's the last episode. The buck stops here, and it's time for me to put my money where my mouth is and take some of these book recommendations and actually read them.
Wait, I thought the premise of the show is that if we told you about the books that you wouldn't have to read them. Isn't that? I thought that's why the Litheads tuned in.
Oh man, that would have been a much better premise because I spent a lot of time reading these books. And it was worth it. Yeah, I think I'm glad I read them.
All right. So are we done?
And we're done.
All right. Litheads, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. No, we're not
Hello,
done.
Hello, I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher, and Happy New Year.
I'm Joseph Holeshoe. I am a high school English teacher, and this is where I usually tell Nick what book he should read, but instead I'm just going to wait here nervously while I find out what this show is going to be about.
Could you audibly bite your nails into the microphone?
Yep, absolutely. Let me just give me a little Foley.
What is that?
That is Litheads for
a
little behind
chip?
The a little behind the scenes magic. I wasn't actually biting my nails. I was sharpening my pencil with this handheld pencil sharpener I have here.
Real quick thinking, Joe.
See, one thing I haven't told you guys for the last 30 episodes is that I actually have a wide array of Foley work here. It's just never come up before.
It's got all sorts of like props to make sound effects.
Do you have one of those
as needed
props that goes like boing, 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 boing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Give me just a second. One second. I have the boinger right here. And boing.
That's stupid. Sorry. That was really disappointing. Sorry, I thought he really had something. That was so upsetting.
No, I have nothing.
No, okay, you're done. You're done. You disappointed us.
Nick, by this point in the show's history, you should know not to expect greatness out of us.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Let's cut into it. I'm going to skip ahead to my 30-second plot of this episode.
Nick, your time has already started, Nick.
Now, unlike Joe, I have not only focused on my 30-second plot, like writing it out and practicing it over and over in the mirror so I get it exactly right, like to the fucking half
Ian
second
does that
every
too.
Episode.
I just think he delivers it a little more naturally.
Joe, this is my 30 seconds. Please don't interrupt. I'm using it to critique Joe's 30 seconds.
Which is also what you use my 30 seconds for.
This is going to be a blow-by-blow critique of all of our failings as podcasters.
That's right. For the next 4 hours.
And 47th, you do this.
I read every single book you recommended, and here are the things you didn't accurately portray.
Can I actually talk, Nick, is your time up? Can I talk seriously about that for a second?
I guess.
Okay, this is you bring this up, the things you didn't accurately portray. This is a really fascinating trend. I've talked to people who are faithful Litheads, listeners of our every episode, hanging upon our lips as we spew forth our wisdom. One of the things that the readers do as they, or the listeners do as they listen to this podcast, is compare what they know of these books to what we say about these books. And I have heard people say, you didn't talk about the right stuff, or I was hoping you would get to this and you didn't get to it. And that's such a fascinating thing.
Yeah.
And so is this an apology, or
this is to everyone, to all the girls I've loved before.
Okay.
And weird. Also everyone else who's related to me, who's
and the other listeners
listening to this. I guess. Yeah. Friends, my friends too, who are listening to this, and Joe's friends and mm-hmm. Nick's friends and all of our host of people who have no idea who we are. But listen, folks, I'm sorry. I didn't get to every single thing about your book. I'm sorry about that. Right. It is absolutely personal, and you should take it as such.
This podcast is long enough. We don't need to say every little thing about the books.
That's true. And Litheads, what you might not hear behind the scenes is when Ian and I talk for too long, Nick is really mean to us. He cuts it out. You don't hear it, but he's
a
jerk.
The mean stuff.
So if we didn't say your thing, it is in our notes, we promise. And we would love to talk to you about it at a party someday. But it's not going to make the show.
Or just tweet at us about all the things we forgot to do.
That would actually be awesome. We would love some negative reinforcement.
Just let us know. Guys, I don't want to give people the impression that this is just going to be an episode where we talk about nothing and they don't get anything out of it.
The Seinfeld of podcast episodes.
I think there's already podcasts for that.
Oh, show about nothing. So I didn't get a chance to read all your books, but a handful of them I had already read.
You're going to coast on those, Nick. Come on.
I would like to point out, this is exactly how students in my class choose which books to talk about, too. The ones that they've already read.
The kid got smart students. But those aren't the ones that I want to talk about. I want to talk about two. Oh, where's my list?
Your list of two?
All right. In no particular order, I decided to take some of your recommendations and read them. So I read The Right Stuff. I read, what else did I read? Pimp.
Two for two.
Heart of Darkness and The Sun Also Rises. So, you know, can't read them all, folks. You know, busy, just so busy with all the things. So these are the ones I want to talk about.
Great.
All right. We're ready.
You know what? It just so happens, it occurs to me that maybe these are the ones that we said were the shortest.
Shut your damn mouth. Quiet, you.
I mean, none of these have pictures, as far as I know.
All right. Well, is it confession time?
He didn't read Shrek. That was the shortest.
Yeah,
that's a surprise.
True. See, that's what people would be thinking, so I skipped it. I read the other short ones. I want to start with The Right Stuff because I'm the most excited about it.
All right. I am excited.
I'm excited too.
So this was a book Joe originally brought. And Joe, give us, what is this book about? Just briefly.
So The Right Stuff is about the very first Mercury astronauts. They were a bunch of Duke guys that were chosen out of not flight school, but they were experimental pilots for the United States. They were chosen to train to go to outer space.
Outer space.
They are outer space. And their names that you know, most famously, I don't want to mess it up. I haven't read it in a while.
So famous.
The Goody Two Shoes, first guy in space.
Nobody help
Large
him.
Tumpkins. Large Tumpkins is his name.
George Washington?
Large Tumpkins.
God. Oh no, Yuri Gagarin, first American in space.
When Google goes wrong. Hey, Nick, do you want to transition and talk to me?
John Glenn, Alan Shepard,
enjoying
Gus
his suffering
Grissom.
Right now.
John Glenn is the Goody Two Shoes that we all famously know, Litheads.
Goody Two Shoes. So, I read this book, and while I was reading it, star of the book, one of the central characters, Chuck Yeager, died.
Oh, yeah, just as we record this, maybe a week ago.
So that piqued my interest because he died in 97.
You want to see
lived a long
what's
life.
This dead guy like?
I want to know a little bit more about this dead guy.
About Chuck Yeager.
I'll just get into it. Joe, this book is so awesome.
It's so awesome.
It's so good. Now, It's unbelievably good.
I don't remember if I won this episode or not.
Yeah, I think you did.
Fantastic. All right, suck it, DeYoung.
And even if you didn't, let's just go with it. So,
all right. let's hear about it. Let's just talk about how much we love this book.
Okay. Instead of that, let's play a game.
Oh, no. Is it a game in which I'm going to be expected to remember things about this book?
You certainly would have an advantage, but I don't think these details you'd have to be successful at this game, unless it was like Fantastic. Some sort of Slumdog Millionaire style win here. So welcome, guys, to our first game in this recap episode. In honor of Chuck Yeager, we will be playing Yeager Facts or Yeager Bombs.
Ooh, good one. Because he was an airline pilot.
That's a good one, Nick.
Here on Yeager Facts or Yeager Bombs, the rules are simple. So the game will go as follows. I will give you a date and the name of a plane, and you will tell me if that plane Yeager bombed or was a Yeager fact.
So okay. Just to be clear, to decode the rules a little bit, if it is a Yeager bomb, is it a plane that
crashed
or That's a plane right. that had nothing to do with Chuck? Oh, a plane that crashed. And you're going to be giving us call numbers like ES-24-56-19?
What?
No, like
when you
XR-71.
Say the name of a plane.
What is a Yeager fact, one that Chuck Yeager flew or one that did not crash?
The rules get a little unclear here, but really the thing to focus here on is it Yeager bomb? Did the plane explode? And if it didn't, it was a Yeager fact.
Now, all right. Okay, let's just do a classic English teacher thing here and unpack this a little.
Yeah.
Nick, did you think of the word Yeager bomb and then think of the fact that Chuck Yeager's in this book and say, I'm going to just jam a game into this somehow, some way?
Do you believe in fate, Ian?
I do. So okay, it was fate, you're saying?
Well, I think Chuck Yeager, yeah.
I think he gave his life for this.
He died so we could play this game.
Oh, God. You guys thought we only had one show about dead celebrities. Well, here comes another one.
Longtime friend of the show, all dead celebrities.
It's okay. Nice because they can never deny it.
That's a great point, Ian. I think we may have something. Okay. Okay, let's jump
right
in. You
start putting out retroactive endorsements?
Just businesses that have
My
closed.
Name is Sean Connery, and I listen to this podcast.
That was Richard Nixon as Sean Connery. Sorry.
Nick, I'm waiting patiently. My sharpened pencil is in hand.
Okay, you won't need that. October 12th, 1944. Meisterschmitt BF-109. Is this a Chuck Yeager bomb or a Yeager fact?
October 12th, 1944.
That's right.
Do we have anything else to go on other than
Messerschmitt? What now?
Meisterschmitt BF. I assume that stands for boyfriend. 109.
109th boyfriend in October?
Yeah. We're going to have a time.
I think a lot
here,
of boyfriends right? do crash and burn in October. So I'm going to say it's a Yeager bomb.
I'm going to say it is a Yeager bomb as well. This is World War II. Like, lots of planes crash.
Oh. Well, congratulations. You got the first one right here. Now, the Messerschmitt BF-109. Now, oh, by the way, guys, we're also going to learn some things along the way here.
Oh, good. Airplane facts.
Secret learning.
Secret learning. That's secret what we like learning. To do here. This was, of course, the day in which Chuck Yeager took down 5 German planes, awarding him the first one in his group, an quote-unquote ace in a day.
Wow.
Which is an aviation award anyone can get for downing at least 5 planes in a single day or more.
I'm going to go down a limb and say that doesn't happen that much anymore. I don't think a lot of there's a lot of
more
like
drones.
Five games. Yeah.
October 14th, 1947, X-1 rocket.
Okay. The X-1 is, I believe, okay, this is the trick.
Talk it out, Joe.
The X-1 is, I believe, the first experimental plane that they basically took a jet and they strapped a rocket engine to it and they pointed it at the sky and lit it, right? If I recall this. Here's the thing. I think eventually that plan worked. I don't know that it was always successful. I'm going to go ahead and say this was a Jaeger bomb.
I'm going to say it was a Jaeger bomb as well, but only because the monkey that they had flying it, they got him real drunk first so as not to be scared.
Hey, and he get did. Off Wikipedia. There's no cheating here. Sorry, gentlemen. That was a Jaeger fact.
Oh.
The X-1 rocket-powered airplane, as they call it.
Which is exactly what it sounds like.
Exactly what it sounds like. So this was the date in which he broke the sound barrier. The first one ever.
Oh, heck. So
this plane was also known as the Glamorous Glennis. Am I saying that right, Joe? Named after his wife. Sure. And he was the first person to hit Mach 1.06, which is 760 miles an hour, which is fucking
crazy.
I
like that we've never really progressed past the idea. Like when it comes to like hitting Mach on land or hitting Mach in the air, like our best idea so far is still strap a rocket to it. Right?
Okay, so here's his reaction to that monumental day in human history, which is good insight into how fucking crazy these people were. Okay, Jaeger shared his disappointment by this historic moment by saying, "There should have been a bump in the road. Something to let you know you had just punched a nice clean hole through the sonic barrier. Later on, I realized this mission had to end in a letdown because the real barrier wasn't in the sky, but in our knowledge and experience of supersonic flight." I love how this guy breaks the sound barrier and is not satisfied at all.
He wants there to be some kind of fancy, like, 2001 A Space Odyssey, like, transition into a field of stars or something.
Yeah, like he passed like, through, boom.
Beyond the sound barrier, there's something cool, like a bowl of avocados that
silence are ripe. Yeah. I was going to say, or avocados, yeah. Mm-hmm. December 12th, 1953,
X-1A. Uh-oh, this is the sequel to the X-1, which everybody knows is never as successful as the original. I'm going to say this is a Jaeger bomb.
I'm going to say it's a Jaeger fact just because I'm feeling contrary.
It is a Jaeger fact. This is when he set a new record. By hitting, this was, let's see, 6 years later, right? Hitting a new record of almost double. So 2.4. Ooh. So 1,650 miles an hour.
That's crazy. Yeah.
All right, let's keep going.
Think about that, folks.
Two more.
Like, think about the idea that in 6 years, you could basically double the top speed of your fastest machine.
Yeah. Just strap more rockets to them.
I think that was the plan.
That is.
Two rockets. That's probably how they did it.
The A stands for all of the rockets. December 10th, 1963, Lockheed NF. It goes on for more numbers, but let's just stick with Lockheed. Lockheed NF.
Lockheed. I was going to say Lockheed.
Is that a Jaeger bomb or a Jaeger fact?
63, you said?
Yeah, December 10th, 63. All this stuff seems to happen in the winter.
Yeah, it must be good flying times. I'm going to go ahead and say it is a Jaeger fact because no fun sounds like NF sounds like no fun. We all know facts are no fun.
That's smart. So. That's context clues.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Joe, do you have any
Sherlock Holmes
guesses? You know, I feel like this is like when the military contractors started to get involved, like Lockheed came out with their version of it. And we know military contractors, they're bloated, the kind of place that would charge you $1,000
for a bolt. Well.
We know them. I think I'm going to say that this is a Jaeger bomb because the people that were alienated this week are the good people at Lockheed Martin. Go fuck yourselves, Lockheed Martin.
Wow. What's Lockheed Martin? That's the maker of the plane?
It is. Yeah. Still a military contractor today.
And you, okay. You must know much more about this than I do. Okay. So this was a Jaeger bomb.
Dang it.
So this.
Was it because of Lockheed's bloat and incompetence?
Jesus. Yeah. Yes, Joe. On December 10th, this is when Chuck Jaeger was flying this thing. And if you want to visualize this, this is a. It looks like a fighter jet plane, but it's completely like
covered in rockets.
It's completely like glassy metal. Like it's completely shiny. And there's a rocket attached to it.
Was the problem that they put rockets pointing both forward and backward?
He just spun in a circle. So this was one of the three planes of its kind made that basically was in between a spaceship and an airplane. So it was the first of its kind, and it could get up to like six figures height wise. So like 120,000 feet in the air, which is like basically space. So this thing, like, they removed the fuel from it, like the fuel line, the regular system, and completely turned this thing into like basically a spaceship.
This thing is very pretty. I'm looking at pictures of it right now.
Unbelievable. It's gorgeous. Yeah.
And every picture of it, it is pointing towards the sky in a 45 degree angle with the rocket coming out of the back.
Yeah, all it does is go up. And so he blew this thing up and barely survived. And the best part about this is that this was a test that was happening, you know, by NASA and whatever, like the military, and like had all this funding in the world. And so because of that, they filmed absolutely everything. So you can look up him crashing this plane from 100,000 feet in the air. And there's like three camera angles, and it's like the 60s, and it's like shot on film. And it's the craziest video ever, because this thing just falls like a pancake out of the air for 100,000 feet. And like 2 seconds before it hits the ground, he ejects out. So you can look that up.
All of these planes that Chuck Yeager himself was flying?
Well, the Messerschmitt was the ones he shot down.
Yeah, with the exception of the German planes.
Okay. Wow. That's like, I always think it's a miracle if you survive one plane crash in your life.
Oh, no. He survived several, I believe. This was just happened to be at 100,000 feet in the air.
Wow.
Okay. I got one last one. Yeager fact or Yeager bomb. The F-15 Eagle.
Jaeger fact.
I'm going to say Jaeger bomb.
It sounds like a Ford F-150, and we all know how factually accurate they are.
Yep, there you go. So congrats, Ian, with the Jaeger fact. Yes. So Chuck Yeager retires from his career in 1975, all right? And basically stays on to help consult and, you know, be involved with the program.
Be crusty at the young kids.
Yeah, tell them they're all dumb, and that's not the way that he would have done it.
Classic old man
so
stuff.
So he retires in 75, right? Mm-hmm. In 2002, he breaks the sound barrier again in the F-15 Eagle.
Nice.
Chuck Yeager.
Comes back. In 2002, 18 years. So he was 70 something?
Math checks out.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Boy, every time I think of that book, I still just think of that opening. Get like, Lidheads, if you don't want to read the entire book of the right stuff, and it's not a super quick book to read, but if you don't want to read the entire book, read chapter one. It's one of my favorite first chapters in any book, and my guess is that you might just keep on reading it after
that. Yeah, it's pretty hard to put down. If you'd like to learn more about Chuck Yeager, he does have an autobiography that I was going to try to read for this, but I just didn't get to it.
That's a lot of homework for one episode.
It's called Yeager, an Autobiography. So,
not very imaginative.
Joe, I read Pimp as well.
Oh, wow. It's another me time. All right.
And no.
Iceberg Slim.
I don't have anything to really talk about. Okay, so you won this book because I was interested in it. But what we basically said is that Ian was so turned off by how this book...
I would describe Ian's attitude as disdainful. Yeah, towards this book.
This might be one of the few books Ian has hated hearing about.
I'm pretty open-minded, but like there's enough bad in the world that I don't need more. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay, so I got into the first like maybe three chapters, and then I immediately sided with Ian. It made me feel so dirty. It is disturbing.
Oh yeah. It is exploitative and manipulative and it's horrible. Also, though, I would argue, Litheads, I continue to argue, it's interesting to read. Oh, I think interesting. Yeah,
certainly nobody could take that away from this book. It is interesting. I may return to it, but that's it. I have nothing else to share about that book. Okay, I also read Heart of Darkness because, yeah, it was extremely short. So that was great. I finished, this book is like 3 hours on audiobook. It's yeah, crazy.
It's like
100 short.
Pages long. Really
That's
fast.
Like Christmas Carol short.
Yeah, I finished it on an airplane to Atlanta. Okay, this is what I have to share about this one.
Yes.
I do, last time, Ian, you mentioned that you weren't sure like the intentions of the author, which
yeah. The whole like, is it trying to say this is bad, this is cruel, or is he
yeah,
like,
it's really weird.
He's just doing a bad job of it. He could do better as a colonizer.
Or would that have been like heavy handed? Like it almost felt like, so in the book, why don't you just remind people what this book's about?
It's a journey. It's, this main character Marlo goes up a river. He is working for a company which is invested in the production of rubber and ivory in Africa. It's kind of turn of the century, turn of the 20th century, colonial times, and he sees just the wreckage caused by this one influential fellow, one employee of the company named Kurtz. So he goes up the river and he's kind of like journeying into terror and evil. And he sees
where,
like,
where else is he journeying to?
He's journeying into the Heart of Darkness.
Oh.
Yes. And then he makes it and he sees him and it's terrifying.
I was much more interested in the colonization of Africa than I was in the story of this book because I really don't know anything about it. And again, more book recommendations that I wish I had more time to read. But I was kind of trying to look up some of the history, and I don't even know if I was going to share it, but I was just looking into it. And I eventually came to the term called Scramble for Africa.
Mm, yes.
Have you ever heard this term before?
I have, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, really?
It's like Hungry, Hungry Hippos, but for Africa.
Oh, my gosh. That I feel like that was probably really offensive.
Wasn't it like basically people thought that Africa was this really, really rich area, which in some ways it was, and that a bunch of different countries just kind of like frantically tried to take it all.
Dibs.
Yeah, it's basically dibs for Europeans. So this term basically is for a period between 1881 and 1914, where the 10% of Africa that was under control by Europe in 1870 increased to 90% in 1914, with the exception of Ethiopia and Liberia being the only ones that stayed independent.
My wife and I are watching The Crown right now, and they keep going on these tours of Africa.
Yeah,
it's like always this plot point. I shouldn't say always, but throughout the first season, there's a couple moments where like they go on a tour of Africa, and every time they go to a country, I sit there and think, I've never heard of that country before, and I look it up, and that's because it's no longer called that thing because that was its colonial name. That's happened multiple times throughout season one.
Nick, you mentioned Liberia. I wonder if either of you guys are familiar with, like, you know, the brief history of this country. It's simultaneously one of my favorite and least favorite like country origins.
Oh, God, no. It's
I know nothing about it.
Sure, tell us.
Okay. Let's hear it.
This is a country in Africa, one of the two that was not under European control. And in the early 1800s, people began, and especially in the North in America, began to say, slavery is bad. But they weren't quite ready to say black people who have been brought here against their will and sold as human chattel should be afforded a part of our society. No, they said, instead of that, we're going to send them back to Africa where they can live in their own kind of model nation, and the country of Liberia was born. So they kind of carved out this area and they said, okay, we will send black people who were brought here, maybe first generation folks brought here, send them back. Maybe folks whose great grandparents came over, were forcibly brought over and sold. And so they were on the plus side. They were trying to take care of people instead of just saying, you're free, now make a way for yourself in an incredibly racist society. That's the plus side. On the minus side, they were like, all of these people from across the continent who have been enslaved and brought over here, we're going to cram them together in this small area with people who the only thing they have in common, other freed slaves, the only thing they have in common is their skin color. No cultural commonality, no language necessarily commonality. They're just like, let's cram it all in together. So this country was just kind of like made up, manufactured, and it is still in existence today.
All right, I got a really dumb question for you.
Please.
Mm-hmm. Was this program, like, were the intentions good? Or was this an evil program? Or
No.
Because it sounds like you could, there's another side to this, maybe.
Well, I feel like this happens a lot throughout history, where it's like, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. But I think this happens a lot where, like, you could imagine at this time where people are like, hey, saying, hey, what do we do with all like these freed blacks that don't have a home here anymore? Like they aren't native here. Like that we're having a hard time assimilating them into our society. And in some ways you could imagine how at the time this sounded like a pretty good idea. Let's give them a home. I mean, it's what we did. It's what happened to the entire Jewish population after World War II in Israel. That's gone really well, by the way. But
go and get guys.
Yeah, I think the idea to the recognition that it's not going to be as simple as, well, they're free, we've solved slavery. They knew that wasn't going to be that simple. I think the desire to ship them away is suspect. Because some of that would have been, well, we don't want to make space for them in our culture. This is not their culture. This is white culture and they should be excluded. So I think that part of it, it's hard to say kind of where the good intentions stop and the self-interested white nationalism starts. But it was not like an evil plan. It wasn't like we're going to go I'll put them on a big boat and then sink it.
Sure. That would be really evil.
pretty evil plan.
No debate on that one. That would be
sorry. Cool. You were talking about the breakfast scramble for Africa.
Okay, so I have two book recommendations that I would like to read one day, or you guys can read it if you'd like. So there are two books that basically talk about this period of colonization in Africa. So the first one is it's called The Scramble for Africa, The White Man's Conquest of the Dark Continent from 1976 to 1912. So this book is basically like the comprehensive, you know, historical perspective. Yeah. So this was written by this historian, Thomas Pakenham, in 1990. It's close enough. It really doesn't matter how you pronounce his last name. So
Thomas, if you're listening, we love you. We're sorry we mispronounced your last name. Anyway,
so he endorses You Don't Know Lit, guys.
Yep.
He endorses You Don't Know Lit.
My name is Thomas Pakenham. You may know me as the author of Scramble for Africa.
Thank you for joining us, Thomas, on this end of the year episode. It was so nice to hear from all of our friends, all of our celebrities. So it's widely regarded as the accurate,
definitive.
Definitive. Thank you. Covers like the wars, the motives, the battles, and like ultimately what happened. So I'm sure it probably covers Libya. But as I was looking at this, I thought, maybe we should have a black person's perspective about what happened.
Oh, Nick, I know where you're going with this. Can I try and forecast it?
Sure.
Things Fall Apart by Chinua Achebe.
Yeah. So this is
I'm going to bring this to the pod sometime.
This is also kind of like a definitive book. So this is a fiction book, a story that's basically you know, based on this guy's experiences and also his father and grandfather's experiences during this period. So he was, it was published in 58. He was born towards the end of this period. So he didn't personally experience a lot of the stuff, but a lot of the stories are like his reaction. And then he, you know, feeds from his, like I said, his father and grandfather's, their actual stories.
I look forward to Ian bringing this book because this is one of those books, and Ian, I bet you have these too. I read this book. Oh. I remember reading this book and liking this book. I know nothing about it anymore. You know, it was 15 years ago. I couldn't tell you anything about it. When I think of Things Fall Apart, I think of that movie that we watched in school called The Gods Must Be Crazy. They're the same thing in my head.
Yep. It's on that. I'm teaching.
It's supposed to be great.
Yeah. Yep. I look forward. Thank you for that recommendation, Nick. I look forward to bringing that to the pod sooner rather than later.
That's what you can expect from these type of review-based episodes.
And I will not be reading Scramble for Africa because, as a rule, I tend not to read books that have dates in their title. Nothing makes a book sound more boring than 1876 through 1912.
So with Heart of Darkness, you folks have all seen the film, the cinematic film called Jaws. That one about the shark.
Jaws? Yeah, I like that movie.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. So this is a classic film example of hiding the monster. When you have this big bad monster, but you keep it underwater or out of sight until kind of the opportune moment. This is the classic film example, but I'm going to use a different one, actually. The excellent 1990 horror comedy film Tremors, which stars Kevin Bacon and Reba McEntire. Are you guys familiar with this film?
Yes.
Tremors?
Yes.
Great film.
I'm not sure where this is going, but I'm following.
Great. In Tremors, it is not immediately clear where the threat is coming from or what the nature of the threat is, in part because you never really get to see the whole of its threatening nature. It's always kind of under the surface. Even in the climax, you don't like get to have a thorough explanation of like what this thing is.
That's why Bigfoot isn't scary. It kind of just looks like Harry and the Henderson.
Right. You need to have a sense of like, I don't know what this is. And in Heart of Darkness, like we kind of follow the path of destruction caused by this guy, this Kurtz that our main character is just following up the river. We see the wreckage caused by him, but we have to wait until the very end to kind of understand him and to get him. And even when we get to the end, we don't really get to that. We don't understand him. We don't comprehend Kurtz. And I think there's something really terrifying about an evil which is inexplicable. And my question that kind of came out of this reflection is, what about reading Heart of Darkness as horror? Like, as not necessarily, I mean, I framed it as a journey, and it's a journey, but like, it's horror.
It's definitely a horror. I read it that way.
Really?
I was even going to say that. So like, my favorite part about it is that it's all in the first person.
Yeah.
It's like his first person narrative, right? Is that how you would, is that the right terminology?
Yes.
And so,
good job.
Like, you have no outside source, and he's like, it's like a mix of like him narrating it from the future, but also like him in the moment, right?
Yeah.
I think it's like a total horror movie because you're in that kind of like you have blinders on, so you can't really see the greater picture,
right? Right.
And you kind and of everything, that's why it feels like a journey. So.
Everything you see makes it kind of like more concerning.
Yeah. Okay, here's the last book I read, The Sun Also Rises, Ian. I liked it.
Bullfighting.
Yeah, it was bullfighting. It was love. Betrayal. It's good. What's the book about, Ian? Remind us.
Well, so it's
no, let me do it. So this book is about, it's about, Ian said it was a coming of age book, but I think they were like older than that, right, Ian? Weren't they like in their 30s?
No. I didn't say, no. You're getting Bildungsroman and Romanoklef mixed up. This is not a Bildungsroman. This is a Romanoklef.
That's not
Romanoklef is the one where like the people map onto specific historical folks.
Yeah. Well, one second. Nick, I've got a great way for you to remember what a Ramanaclef is, because I think it literally translates to like a book with a key, like a novel with a key. So right. You can almost imagine that once you figure out, oh, Ernest Hemingway is supposed to be, who is he in this book?
The author. Oh, the main character.
Yeah, so like, oh, Ernest Hemingway is the main character, then you can start piecing together what's going on in the book, like as soon as you have that key, Ramanaclef.
I don't even remember what you just said right now.
Well, Nick, Ian and I wanted to spring this on you, but I think you should start remembering it because we have prepared a midterm examination for you at the end of this episode.
Oh, shit. All right. Well, I'm going to one up you real quick with another game.
Time for a game.
All right. Welcome. Back to one of our favorite recurring segments, Hemming Fact or Hemming Fiction.
Oh, yes. Hemming Fact or Hemming Fiction.
It returns.
Are we sure it wasn't Hemming Fact or Hemming Fake? I don't remember.
Fake sounds better.
I think it may have been Hemming Fake.
Hemming Fact or Hemming Fake.
Yeah, or whatever game people out there celebrate. Yeah. They can all celebrate their own.
'Tis the season.
But this is a very special version. It's the drink edition.
Oh, no.
Now, as I was looking into this book a little bit more, I came across the internet and it told me this quote about the book and the main characters in the book. And like we said, it is a young coming of age story or whatever. Nope. And it's about all these kids and adults. I don't know. Really, I don't know how old they are. I thought they were like in their 20s, but I think they might be in their 30s. And there's like other characters that they meet along the way who are much older. And they basically drink constantly.
Oh, my gosh.
And they drink so much.
It's like they're drunk. Well, every page is another drink.
We ordered another 8 gallons of wine and polished it off pretty quickly.
I woke up and had my coffee and of course, 8 brandies. It's okay. So this internet person said, if alcoholics drink like fish, this cast drinks like whales. There are websites dedicated to how much they drink. And so I have some drinks for you guys, and you're going to tell me if they were a Hemming Fact. As in they were in the book, or were they Hemming Fiction or fake that aren't in the book?
If we were playing this game right after I read the book, I would ace it, but I'm gonna
lose. Maybe you'd ace it. There are so many drinks.
There are a lot of drinks.
Somebody outlined all the drinks and I was going to tally them up, like how many drinks do they actually do? And I started doing it and there were so many that I just gave up on that.
Numbers don't go that high.
I decided this was too much work.
Here's a fun idea for a drinking game based on that book. Every time someone takes a drink in that book, you take a drink, and then you die of alcohol.
You wouldn't finish the book. All right, first drink. A Jack Rose. Is this a Hemming Fact or Hemming Fake?
A Jack Rose. I'm going to go ahead and say it's a Hemming Fact because I think it's probably better to start with a Hemming Fact to establish the premise of the game.
Who won the last game?
I did.
It doesn't matter. Winners don't matter on this podcast.
I'm going to say it's a Hemming Fact.
And I think it's Jack Daniels and cherry juice.
Okay. So it is a Hemming Fact. This drink was actually made famous because of this book. A Jack Rose is made with applejack, grenadine, lemon, or lime juice. And that kind of sounds gross.
I think applejack's okay. Applejack is kind of like an apple-y whiskey with a little bit of grenadine. I think that'd be a nice
sweet
Christmas
and sour
drink.
Yeah, okay. Maybe a little cinnamon in there, Joe.
Ooh, yeah, maybe a cinnamon stick.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe serve it hot.
Definitely. Boil it.
That actually might be gross. Yeah.
Nothing like hot lemon juice to get you going.
Mm-hmm. All right. Mind you, these are all famous Spanish drinks. And by famous, I mean they drink them in Spain. Aguardiente. Aguardiente.
Can you spell it for us, Nick?
A-G-U-A-R-D-I-E-N-T-E.
Yeah, I think that's a Hemming Fact.
Yeah, it sounds like a drink. I don't have a plausible reason that this is not a drink.
Yeah.
Hang on. These are all drinks. It's just the question of
they're all
are
drinks.
They in the book or not?
I'm not making up words like a wizard.
Okay, in that case, sure, it's in the book. I mean, fact.
Oh, boy.
I love how dialed in Joe is to this game.
Yeah, sure, fuck it. Yeah, this was a drink, too. It's very similar to schnapps.
That's nice.
Yeah, but what kind of schnapps?
Any schnapps. Here's the next drink.
Spanish schnapps.
Did you know that Abraham Lincoln served Applejack when he was a barkeeper in Illinois?
Yeah.
You did. Okay, cool.
Great. I didn't know that. I think that's amazing. I love the idea of Abraham Lincoln as a barkeeper. I feel like I like him so much more now.
Yeah, definitely. All right, a Clara.
Clara. I think this just means like water or something. Or I don't think this is an alcoholic drink in the book.
I'm going to say Hemming fake.
I don't like how dialed in you guys are to this game. It's really making it unfun.
I'm going to say Hemming fake because Clara was famously the name of Hemingway's pet beluga whale, and he would not include a drink named after a whale in his book.
And while he would shoot sharks with his machine gun, as you remember, Litheads, that was mounted on his boat, he would only ever tenderly pet his beluga whale, Clara.
He had a beluga whale called Clara? It's probably named after this drink, which is a popular Spanish drink, which is basically like a shandy. It's like beer and lemon.
Oh, nice.
Lemonade. Yeah, all right, last one. Sangria.
Wait, hang on. Was that in the book or not?
No, it was a Hemming fiction.
It was a Hemming fake. Okay, I feel like sangria is... I feel like this is the distractor.
You guys are about to win $1 million. And it's really
sangria
not fun.
Definitely is in this book. Hemming fake. Hemming fact. Hemming
wow,
fact.
Wow, I was going to make an elaborate case for this being a Hemming fake. But like the students in my classroom, Ian is so confident that I just believe him now.
Unless I'm misleading you to make you tank it.
Nope. Sangria is in this book. Ian would never do that.
No, it is ironically not in this book.
Oh, no.
That's a Hemming fake.
That's where... Oh, I thought for sure they were like hanging out in some really warm cafe and they got some sangria. Do you guys know where the name Applejack comes from? So the traditional method of producing Applejack, the whiskey, is called jacking.
Oh, boy. And
jacking is the...
Please go on.
Jacking is the process of taking cider that has fermented and freezing it and then breaking the ice and fishing the ice out. And as you freeze it, you kind of force the water out of it and it makes it stronger, which I think...
Oh, so it's like just like the sugars, like the concentrated sugars that would then ferment.
No, no, no. You ferment the cider first, then you put it outside, preferably in an oaken bucket, and freeze it.
Got it.
And then you break the ice off the top. It just seems very like New England. Like you need to have alcohol, but you can't have a distillery set up. So instead, we're just going to jack it.
Wow.
Huh. I thought it meant something completely different.
Nope. Anytime anyone uses the phrase jacking it, that's what they're referring to.
That's what they're mean. Okay. Well,
yep.
This is good. That's why I come to this podcast, so I can learn some things.
That's why they call it lit.
That's why they call it literature.
That's why they call it lit.
As I thought about this book, I realized that I kind of sold it as this really fun, like, romp with bullfights and fishing. But it's really, there is a lot of time of, like you say, Nick, drinking and hanging out in the city. So, like, there's this real juxtaposition between sort of the active life, the rural stuff, the country stuff, and the cultured life in the urban center. A lot of the book is focused on cafes and clubs and restaurants and hotels and the social round in Paris and the sort of adventure flashy stuff like bullfighting and fishing is comparatively little of the book. And as I've thought about this more, I kind of reflecting on Hemingway's biography, I kind of wonder if this is him working through two different scenes that he likes. So he likes the sort of cafe, hard drinking, social scene, but he also really likes going out and like fighting and killing things and having an adventure. And it kind of feels like he's at this hinge point in his life where he's choosing which one do I do? And this book is working through the two, kind of the two different options available to him. And he ended up actually pursuing a more active lifestyle after the 1920s. So it's fascinating that this book comes out and we see him kind of moving to a more you know, the kind of life where he shoots sharks with a machine gun.
Yeah, it's the one star review I read said nothing happens. Yeah, I get why people would think that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yep. Definitely.
It's more. Yeah. It's pretty much about. I don't know. It's about life.
It's life, man.
Yeah. Like, there's not a lot of like drama. Well, there's actually a lot of drama. It's not like a lot of like, I don't know, people dying. I don't know.
Interpersonal.
No, there's actually people dying too.
Yep.
I don't know. That person just sucks.
All right, Nick, as you remember from college, right around Christmas time, right around the new year, you would take your final examination. And Ian and I, Nick, have prepared a very, very brief, but relatively comprehensive final exam for you.
Okay, I'm ready.
Nick, there are a bunch of different levels at which you can understand something. Right. And this is like just teacher 101
for sure,
stuff, right?
For sure.
So you can just straight up regurgitate knowledge. You can show comprehension. You can like show analysis or evaluation of it, right? And these things are taught to you in teacher school, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But as a result of this, when teachers write their final exams, they try to, well, do a couple of things. But one of the things that they try to do is have like a nice broad scattering of the knowledge so that we can really understand where the students fall in this spectrum.
You gotta have a nice scattering.
You gotta have a nice scattering. So, Nick, I have just a handful of knowledge and comprehension questions for you, which are the lowest tier of understanding.
Ooh.
And then, Nick, I have one very scary synthesis question for you. And the synthesis is, of course, the highest level of understanding. So, Nick, are you ready?
Yeah.
All right. Nick, we have read at least one book this year written in the epistolary style. it was a book that Dr. Ian DeYoung brought to us, and it was, Ian?
The vampire, Count Dracula.
The vampire book. Yeah, Count Dracula.
Oh, shoot. I thought that was going to be the question because I knew that. No, damn it.
Sorry. That's how teachers get you.
Yep.
I thought I was really going to really bring it there. All right. Keep going, Joe.
Nick, can you please explain for the litheads who maybe missed that episode, can you please explain to them what the epistolary style is?
All right. I think I know this, but I'm sure I'll get parts of it wrong. It's when a book, in this case a book, is written from, shit.
No, just roll with it.
Well,
you're good.
You're doing great.
I don't need your fucking bullshit. I don't need your fucking pats on the back. I'm fine. I know it. Well, that book is written from the point of view of letters from character to character. But I don't know if that's a definition of whatever that word is.
Ian, what do you think?
I think that's exactly right. You're a little bit off in that the book is all letters. There is one section which is a transcription of a wax cylinder, but for the most part, yes, it is written
just
in letters and diaries.
So I think I did really well on that first question.
Yeah,
I
totally agree. You did really well. All right, Nick, we have bandied about a couple of different literary terms that sound an awful lot alike. One is, of course, a Romana Clef, and the other is a Bildungsroman.
Mm-hmm.
Nick, can you explain for the litheads the difference between a Romana Clef and a Bildungsroman?
Probably not well. Is that an answer to the question? That was the question.
It is an answer.
Can I do it?
Answer.
Can I do it? Not very well. Next question, Joe.
I feel like Nick has found a loophole.
Yeah, I'm what you call a teacher's quote unquote worst nightmare.
Well, Nick, as we've explained to you several times this year, including earlier in this episode,
there's times the charm.
A Romana Clef, like The Sun Also Rises, is a novel with a key that once you figure out the that that Ernest Hemingway is in fact our narrator, then a bunch of stuff begins to make sense.
I didn't know that when I was reading it.
Buildings Roman, we've talked about a handful, I want to say, Buildings
Earthsea.
Roman.
Yep.
Earthsea, that's the one that comes to mind for me. Buildings Roman, Nick, is like The Goonies or The Sandlot or maybe Ferris Bueller's Day Off. It is a coming-of-age story. Stand By Me, right? It is a coming-of-age story. It is finding out
the
who
Goonies.
You are. The Goonies. That's exactly it.
Good. All right. So,
Nick, those were the easy questions. I've got one more for you. This one's a little tricky to the point that you might just cut it out entirely. All right, Nick, we talked about sonnets on this show.
Yes,
on a couple different occasions, we've discussed sonnets.
Are you going to ask me to write you a sonnet?
No, I'm not. I did.
Okay, good.
He's not going to ask you to write him a love song.
A love sonnet, yeah.
If this were a blue book exam, I would ask you to write me a sonnet, but it is not. It's an oral examination. So instead, Nick, I am going to ask that you compose one line of iambic pentameter for us.
No, it's ridiculous. Ridiculous.
This is so brutal.
Joe, you knew I was going to fail this.
No, I don't. I think this is doable. A sonnet is, of course, made up
Did
of
you
a bunch
hear
of
the
lines.
Questions I asked you guys. A Jack Rose. What's that? Is that drink a real one in the book? And then you got it. And everybody was so happy. We all got the answers right. And we just moved on with another question that you got right. And you got them all right. And then the segment was done. I don't know this one, Joe.
Where
are my softballs?
Let me make it a little easier for you.
Where are my softballs?
Oh, dear.
Ian and I can give you a couple of lines of iambic pentameter, right? Like, we'll just give you a Shakespearean line, right?
Yes.
And I think you'll get an ear for it relatively quickly.
Okay.
So, Ian, I'm going to take an easy one because you have a deeper knowledge here. Nick, shall I compare you to a summer's day is a line of iambic pentameter. Shall I compare you to a summer's day?
What is the question?
Right now you're getting an ear for it right now.
Okay.
Shall I do one? To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take
that's
arms
enough.
Against the seeming troubles.
That's more than one
quite
line.
Enough. And what would you like me to do with all these ones that you're feeding me?
Ideally, Nick, what I would like you to do is I would like you to summarize any book that we've read together this year, any Ooh. Book that we've talked about in a single line of iambic pentameter.
I don't want to play this.
Nick is extremely unmotivated.
How about you do one? How about as our teaser, you do one for what we're going to read next week.
Okay. That sounds good to me.
Okay.
Why don't you both do Lord of the Rings?
Okay.
Perfect.
Okay.
And in the while you put that together, I'll explain why. So January 3rd, I think, is Tolkien's birthday. So we're going to go through all the Lord of the Rings books and do just like an episode per book. We didn't know how else to do it. And we really want to talk about Lord of the Rings.
Desperately.
And we'll really try to make sure Ian doesn't just tell you Hobbit facts for an hour. Because that would be the fucking worst.
It'll be me shouting into my microphone for 45 minutes. So, one line summary of The Fellowship of the Ring. A group of friends departs to save the world.
Oh, that's so good.
It's
Joe,
so
is yours going to be as good as that?
I think only slightly worse. Only slightly worse. Mine is Frodo has been called to burn the ring.
Ooh,
Frodo
oh,
has
that's pretty
been
good
called
nice.
To burn the ring.
I will say that Frodo is not a iamb.
Ah, fucking.
But I kind of think I have a couple in here which aren't iambs too, so we're even.
Right, where the syllable shift is off, the syllable emphasis is off. Yeah, Frodo.
And so what is iambic pentameter?
So Nick, as you know, of course, and thank you for asking that question for the benefit of the legions of litheads, iambic pentameter
For the litheads, just for them, not anybody else.
Iambic pentameter, as you know, Nick, is a line of 10 syllables composed in iambs, which is a stressed and unstressed pair. So when Dr. Ian DeYoung says a group of friends
departs, finish up, please. A group of friends departs to save the world.
A group of friends departs to save the world. We get 10 syllables in that line, and it has a really nice bouncy rhythm throughout those 10 syllables. It follows a stressed, unstressed pattern, which is an iamb.
Nick, do you have an idea for our closing quote?
No, and I also didn't prepare one.
I could do one. I've got one, which is kind of weird, okay, but
sure.
Fun. Let me set this quote up. You folks will remember earlier in the year, we had our Cormac McCarthy episode featuring the road and all the pretty horses. So we talked in that episode about a novel by McCarthy called Blood Meridian, which is his best reviewed novel. This is a novel which has been called the great American novel. It's a triumph of postmodern storytelling, but don't let that turn you off. It's also super just gripping. It's also been called the most violent novel ever, which seems about right. And I'm going to read you a quote which has a little bit of that violence in it. There's no background needed for this. There are a couple of people in Texas and they're out in the wilderness, as often happens in Cormac McCarthy. And this is the quote. It was an old hunter in camp, and the hunter shared tobacco with him and told him of the buffalo and the stands he'd made against them, laid up in a sag on some rise, with the dead animals scattered over the grounds, and the herd beginning to mill, and the rifle barrel so hot the wiping patches sizzled in the bore, and the animals by the thousands and the tens of thousands, and the hides pegged out over actual square miles of ground, the teams of skinners spelling one another around the clock, and the shooting and shooting, weeks and months till the boar shot slick and the stock shot loose at the tang, and their shoulders were yellow and blue to the elbow, and the tandem wagons groaned away over the prairie, 20 and 22 ox teams, and the flint hides by the 100 ton, and the meat rotting on the ground, and the air whining with flies and the buzzards and ravens, and the night a horror of snarling and feeding with the wolves half-crazed and wallowing in the carrion. I seen Studebaker wagons with 6 and 8 ox teams headed out for the grounds, not hauling a thing but lead, just pure galena, tons of it. On this ground alone between the Arkansas River and the Concho, there were 8 million carcasses, for that's how many hides reached the railhead. 2 years ago, we pulled out from Griffin for our last hunt. We ransacked the country. 6 weeks. Finally found a herd of 8 animals, and we killed them and come in. They're gone. Every one of them that God ever made is gone, as if they'd never been at all. The ragged sparks blew down the wind. The prairie about them lay silent. Beyond the fire it was cold, and the night was clear, and the stars were falling. The old hunter pulled his blanket about him. I wonder if there's other worlds like this, he said, or if this is the only one.